Welcome, weary traveller, to the humble establishment that I like to call Shonky Lab. I am your barkeep, Elton, and today we have travelled back to the Middle Ages to partake in a discussion about wars, rats, illness, kings and queens, and the odd establishment of ill repute, if you know what I mean.
Sounds great.
To make my journey easier on this quest, I've requested the help from the fairest of fair maidens.
Oh, thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, Teresa.
Hello.
Oh,
nice
God.
To be here.
What? For out, where is that hideous accent from? It's like a thousand knives have been plunged into my ears.
Oh, thanks very much. Yeah, medieval history from someone who grew up in a country that hadn't been discovered yet.
Yes,
well, it has. Well, actually, no, technically it has. I was read in a history book once. It's like Captain Cook discovered America, Australia. We were just talking about America, and which was a great surprise to the Aboriginal people. He'd been there for about 50,000 years.
Exactly, as if they were sat around going,
I know, waiting for the white people to turn up and tell them how to live in houses. Like, fuck off.
Yeah, when are they turning up? When are they turning up to pillage and ruin this beautiful land?
We can't wait to be civilised. Oh, controversial.
Where are our saviours? Where are they? We need our saviours to make us more civilised and to bring coin and to bring other stuff into our lives, like yobbos. What is an asbo as well? We're looking forward to asbos and cars.
Can't wait.
And mobile phones.
Yeah. Sounds brilliant.
Okay. Yes. So, yeah, we're going to talk about or try and talk about medieval times.
Yes.
And so is it all just about illness and castles and fighting and stuff?
Probably a fair bit of it, yes. Where to start? I'm interested to know what years you think medieval times cover, because it, even with different historians, it differs.
Okay.
When I say medieval, what do you think?
Well, when you say medieval, I think of people cooking with cauldrons and rats running around. I think of Robin Hood. I think of Maid Marian and her Merry Men.
I should have heard her Merry Men. That's very progressive.
Have you never seen that program?
What? Which one?
The Tony Robinson one. Oh, you'll love it.
I'm not sure I have, actually. Was it a... like a drama, like a comedy series.
Yeah, it's a children's comedy series.
Oh, I've seen sort of snippets of it, but I don't think I will have to watch that now.
And they meet a man called Snooker, and they give him his name's Snooker, and I think he has this game that he wants to invent, and someone gives him some balls and some sticks, and he's like, oh, okay, and he goes off and invents Snooker.
Oh, brilliant. I've got to watch that. I forgot. I must ask to get that.
Yeah. It's silly, but it's good fun. It's good fun. So when do I think? I did the tiniest amount of research. And
well, it's a real rabbit warren of you put medieval history into a search and, yeah. Like I say, there's so many different facets of it. And different countries, and it just seems to just grow and grow. So, but the time that you're sort of probably looking at is probably Robin Hood was sort of around, like the part that I studied, the Angevin kings. You've probably heard of Richard I, the Lionheart.
Yep.
So around that time, and I believe Robin Hood was sort of set around when Richard went off to fight in the Crusades, and right. like the evil King John, well, he was only Prince John then, pretty much tried to take over. So, but then Richard came back and kicked his ass pretty much.
Right.
But, yeah, and so that was, well, Richard was, he became king in 1189.
Okay, so this is kind of like in the middle of the medieval period, yes. isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Well, the medieval period sort of begins not just after the Romans sort of, you know, pulled up stumps and basically went back to try and save their empire. Well, especially the Western Roman Empire pretty much was collapsing.
Yeah.
And, you know, England was pretty much the last sort of conquest of theirs, and it was very much the like the on the outer regions. And there is, it's probably one of the only historical events that has documentary evidence, really, because the governor of Britain writes to the big cheese in Rome and says, look, we've got a lot of the Germanic tribes were, you know, looking for new places to settle. So he writes to the, I can't remember whether it's the emperor or not at that stage, and says, you know, please send more troops. And he pretty much gets the reply back, like, you know, look to your own defences, and withdraws pretty much the whole Roman garrison. So, and that was the 400s.
Okay.
Keep in mind they'd been there, I think they invaded in 54 AD. So, that, you know, it's a good 300-odd years.
That's bonkers, isn't it?
The actual
length of time.
Yeah, well, a lot of people don't realise, you know, that people were pretty much Romanised. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of evidence of that. But, yeah, so we sort of medieval, sort of early medieval is sort of 500, 600, sort of around that time.
Yeah.
Pretty much goes up. Well, I've always had an interest in the Tudors, but they're very much early modern. Because my interest in history really started. I can't remember when I wasn't interested in history, because my dad was a massive history. Oh, just like an encyclopedia.
Really?
Yeah. Awesome. And I remember watching. Yeah, he was amazing. The series on Elizabeth the First with Glenda Jackson, really, really excellent series, and she's pretty much to me as the quintessential Elizabeth the First.
Yeah,
yeah. So that got me real. That really reeled me in and made me interested. So, but that's sort of the moving out of the medieval period. I think it's still considered within that time frame, but it's sort of, like I say, if you studied it at university, that would be early modern.
Right. So, okay. Yeah. So that's more going into, so I don't know any of my ages, but I suppose that would be, well, I don't know. I'm trying to think.
What do you mean? Sorry.
Well, you come out. There's a period in time where everyone's like living in castles and everyone's living in wet huts, and then all of a sudden it's like the industrial age, and there's something in the middle there that's huge that I'm not too sure what it's called.
Okay. Yeah, probably. Because my main interest is probably around the conquest, the Norman conquest, which is 1066, the one that everybody seems to know.
Nice.
Yeah, yeah. I always remember my mum saying that's the only date in history she remembers, you know, Battle of Hastings. She didn't know who fought in the Battle of Hastings, when it was, what were the consequences of it, but she knew that, and that was good. But that was pretty much a massive, massive turning point in the history of England, because you go from the Anglo-Saxons, which are the pretty much came out of the Germanic tribes, the Angles and the Saxons. And yeah, that pretty much changed the whole government. And I can't imagine, but it would have still, you know, I'm not saying that the Normans were the great civilizers, but it would have gone in a completely different direction.
Yeah.
And then I'm sort of, like I say, the Angevins, what they call, began with Henry II in 1154. Mm-hmm. And he was the, now let me get this right, I think he was the, who's that? Matilda was his mother, so she was a great-grandson of William the Conqueror.
Okay.
If I'm getting that right, yes. So, and his son was Richard the First. Well, he had too many sons, and that was the problem. They're constantly fighting each other for control.
Yeah.
So
is that the type of era that you're interested in? That is that what you studied for all these years, or was there other eras?
Yeah, I've studied quite a broad range of modules. But my main module in my bachelor's degree was called The Devil's Brood, the Angevins, which, like I mean, is what have you heard of the Plantagenets?
Yes.
Yeah. So it wasn't sort of like people didn't really have surnames then. A lot of people sort of get that wrong. And a lot of it is historians sort of just pretty much just putting like a category in that on that sort of era. Well, I think they were known as Plantagenets, but it's a bit different to today. Like they didn't need surnames in those days. No, a bit like the Tudors probably didn't really refer to themselves. It's more like it's a bit like the movie Dune. You know, they have the houses, House Atreides, and yeah, it's like the House of Tudor, or like the Wars of the Roses were the Houses of York and the Houses of Lancaster. Just different branches of the royal family.
So you're placed under a house, and you are Elton from House.
Yeah.
Whatever it is,
pretty
and
much.
That's it.
Yeah. And whoever pretty much has control of the nobles has, you know, is in power. How can I describe it? Uneasy lies the head that wears the crown, I think, is a classic Shakespeare quote, which is is very true. Yeah, it's very difficult if you are not a strong ruler to hang on to power.
I would have. Did power shift and change hands a lot through these years then?
Oh, God, yeah. And like I said, with Henry II's sons, he had a son who actually crowned king within his lifetime, which was pretty much to secure the succession.
Yeah.
So that was sort of Henry Jr., really. And then there was another son, Geoffrey, but I think he died in a jousting tournament. So then there was Richard and John. So he constantly spent all this time dividing up this they call it the Angevin Empire. It was pretty much England and like a lot of territory in France.
Yeah.
And his wife is was named by the lady of Eleanor of Aquitaine, who was very much a formidable leader in her own right. I could just talk for hours about these people. They were just amazing. And she was like a daughter of a duke, an heiress, and a lot of power came from how much land you had, and very much these heiresses were incredibly powerful because they, you know, they would, the men would hold this land because they couldn't, the women couldn't really do it themselves, but they had to hold it in the right of their wife.
Okay.
So, yeah. So he, that's how he, could, when he married her, he obtained a hell of a lot of land. Because when you think about countries now, you, it wasn't really the same then because the concept of a nation is very, very new.
England was fractured all over the place, wasn't it?
Very much so, yeah, yeah, yeah. There were different kingdoms, yeah.
Would they put the land with the lady because the man's more likely to go off and fight and then die?
Well, yeah. How it sort of worked was pretty much if a duke, her father, like her older brother, died, so... Oh, what would they call it? She was like, she held the land pretty much.
Mm.
But if she married, yes, he could pretty much absorb that, like Henry did, into his territories, really.
Right.
He did. A lot of the time, women were. They still held a certain amount of power, especially Eleanor. She was an amazing woman. But you really only showed up in history when you're attached, either you're the sister of someone, the wife, the mother. Like she was the wife of two kings. She was formally married to the King of France. But she didn't have any boy babies, so... And then, so she married Henry and had probably about five. So,
didn't it get fractured over in France as well? I don't know. There was a king that didn't produce an heir, and so the crown was kind of spinning up in the air, and people were fighting over it Is that like the Hundred Year War? I'm sure that's the Hundred Year War, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a little bit later. That's sort of Edward the First.
Right. Okay.
No, sorry, Edward. Oh, get me, Edward's wrong. Edward the Third, sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
And his, like I said, the Wars of the Roses came about because him and his wife had a lot of children. They get some raw marriages. They have maybe one or two children. It's like, you're never touching me again. Mm-hmm. And he obviously got along very well with his wife because they had about 13 children.
Wow.
A lot of sons. And unfortunately, they had sons. Well, not unfortunately for them, but then, of course, you get a lot of, like I say, the houses fighting over power.
Mm-hmm.
So,
So having lots of siblings, does that create like mini civil wars in each house then?
Probably, yeah. Some more than others. Sometimes it's easier. You get but even like with the Tudors, Henry VIII was never meant to be king. He had an older brother. So Eugene had the heir and the spare, which was pretty much how it worked.
Yeah.
You've got to have you've got to have the heir, who is pretty much just, he goes into his own sort of household and is educated to be a king, which was what happened to Arthur, Henry's older brother.
Yeah.
But then he unfortunately died when he's a teenager. So then they have to, we've got to cram all this into Henry, who just really wasn't interested. He just wanted to go out and do jousting.
Yeah.
So, it's, I hate to compare it to Game of Thrones, but it is a bit like that.
Well, surely that's where Game of Thrones gets its inspiration from, all the houses and all the wars and fighting and sex and boobs and stuff like that. That's where it all comes from.
Yeah, unfortunate thing is, like, people think all medieval history is just that, and a lot of it is, just like normal life. There's a great line in the Monty Python the Holy Grail. So, well, that must be a king. Well, why? Because he ain't got shit all over him. Pretty much it. That's how it was for the ordinary person. You know, just the management changed and they just, yeah, keep plugging away.
Yep.
But at the same time, their lives were more attuned to the seasons. Like now they would have, they'd be working towards the Christmas period and then, you know, get everything done and then just basically have a booze up until, you know, January.
Really?
We have a couple of days off and they had, it was a great season of just merrymaking and, well, you can't really do sort of a lot farming-wise.
Well, you make hay while the sun shines, don't you?
Pretty much, yeah. So I don't think it was all sort of they pretty much discredited the whole Dark Ages business, especially between that's probably earlier than what they're speaking, but pretty much when the Romans left and the Normans showed up, a lot of people tended to think that everybody just banged rocks here together sort of thing. It's just completely not the case. Like there was no civilization. It's just the lack of evidence that, you know, it wasn't, there's not a lot of evidence to show what really happened, but yeah.
So where, I sound like I should be in school, but.
No.
Where are the Normans from then? Would you know where they are from?
From France.
From France, and they're invading England, are they?
Yes. So, and they originally descended from, because Norman is sort of shortened from Northmen, who are pretty much the Vikings, you know, the invaders, and they were settlers really from Scandinavia, from Norway and Sweden. So how the conquest of England, pretty much the last Anglo-Saxon king died without an heir. So he had pretty much, well, allegedly promised the crown to William of Normandy. He was formerly known as William the Bastard because his parents weren't married, but he wasn't a terribly nice man at the same time.
Right.
But he was promised.
That's one way
the crown.
To fit into your name, isn't it?
Yeah. Well. There's a joke that he only invaded England because he wanted a new nickname, but.
These English people, they call me a bastard.
Peasants, bloody hell.
Yeah, I'll show you.
But after this, I think it's, what was his name? Edward the Confessor, because he was very, very pious, religious man. He dies. And then one of his nobles, Harold, pretty much seized the throne. One of the powerful nobles, one of the powerful families. And so when William gets word of this, he's absolutely fuming. Mm. So he pretty much invades, gets very lucky with the weather, and pretty much just rolls up. Oh, and probably at the same time, the Danish are still sort of attacking England, so they with – actually, Harold's brother, I can't remember his name, I think it's Tostig, he tries to invade and take power with a colourful character called Harold Hardrada. And so they try and invade, and so Harold has to, I think that was in the north, the Battle of Stamford Bridge. So he comes up and pretty much beats him. His brother gets killed in the process.
Yeah.
And so then, unfortunately, at the same time, in October 1066, William invades from the south. So he has to pretty much hightail it back down south. Yeah. Doesn't listen to his wife. And she just says, you know, just let William rattle around in the south of England, because it's very, very time consuming and expensive to have an army in a foreign country. And same as now, you've got to find resources, you've got to feed your men. So she just said, you know, just ignore him, just stop and he'll just go home. But he didn't. He raced his men down there, and so we ended up with a Norman king. Was crowned on Christmas Day in 1066.
That was the Battle of Hastings then, where
it was,
lost the king.
Yeah, yeah. Harold Godwinson, the old allegedly, you know, the bio tapestry.
Have you seen that?
That pretty much amazing. It just, not sure how true it is, but you know, it was pretty much written by the victors. So that's when the big regime change. Anglo-Saxons are pretty much second class citizens in their own country.
All of that travelling across England, there's no railways. There's nothing like that at all, is there?
There aren't even roads.
No. It's horseback and that's
pretty
it.
Much. Yeah, yeah. And in boggy sort of winter country, you know,
it's England.
Imagine.
Of course it is.
Yeah, I know. It's even now people whinge, but, you know, at least you got roads and stuff like that. You know, the railways might be shit, but at least they're there. You know, they had pretty much, well, a lot of it was, especially in London, it was water-based. So, you just sort of, the Thames was, we were watching something the other night. The Thames was a lot wider, so they had any way to get around was pretty much up the Thames. Yeah.
On the boats and
on the boats,
and
yeah,
such,
like little
yeah.
ferries and yeah. Yeah.
Big Imagine boats, little that. Boats.
Yeah, yeah. No roads. Horseback.
And a little man with coconuts walking behind you.
I've always been a massive Monty Python fan, so it's probably a lot of that is my interest. It's the French guy. Hello, what do you want?
We shall use my larger skills.
Probably my favourite movie. Yeah. John Cleese is a Frenchman hurling abuse. You know, I pretty much could recite that as a child.
Go away, I shall taunt you a second time.
You English niggits. It took me a while to realise what he was actually saying.
I told him we already got one.
Sorry, I'll stop with the quoting now.
No, we could quote all night, honestly. Do you know anything about the Magna Carta? Because that's been brought up a couple of times since this bloody coronavirus has reared its ugly head, hasn't it?
Has it? In what sort of context?
People wanted to keep their shops open. And so they said, well, in the Magna Carta, it says that we can keep our shops open because they're our shops and we are allowed to earn a wage from them. It's like, okay, Magna Carta is like, what, is it 500 years old-ish?
1215. Lot older. Yeah.
A lot more than that.
We were talking about King John again. You know, the Magna Carta came about because pretty much he was a really bad king. Probably not a lot of it was his fault. I mean, the guy that I, sort of tutor and lecturer, wrote a book about King John, so he was pretty much an expert on him. And history doesn't exist in a vacuum. You know, there's a narrative that goes through, and some people get lucky, some people don't. John got very, very unlucky. He was the youngest son. He was meant to go into the church. He was called John Lackland because he had too many older brothers. He pretty much just gobbled up everything else. So then Richard went and got himself killed, so he ended up as king. And his barons, like I said to you before, the kings really depend on the nobility for support. And if they, any time in history they've been fighting them, there's been civil war and unrest, and not civil war, but pretty much close to it. A real sort of fight for power. And this Magna Carta, the Great Charter, is pretty much a list of demands against the king.
Okay. So, and this is from like the common person, is it? Or is it from the church, or is it from higher ups?
Probably from what we probably would call, the nobility. Some of the things were sort of put in there. You know, I think one of them is that you're pretty much just not allowed to take land from anyone without, just go in and take their land. But, there was quite a divide between the poor and the rich in those days. So, the people working on the land were either peasants or serfs who pretty much didn't have any right, and they had to ask their lord for everything. But I can't remember how many. It's quite an amazing document. I've seen a couple of the originals. There's one in the, not the British Museum, the British Library, which is an original.
Oh, really?
There's not that many, because when they did sort of write them all out, they sent them all to all the churches, the cathedrals in the land. Pretty much, because they were pretty much in charge. They were the people who were educated and could read and write and pretty much just say, this is what the king says.
So someone to go over it and proofread it, basically.
And just to keep a record of it, really. That's why we have copies that exist, because they've just been kept and looked after, and not that many.
Yeah.
One of the lecturers where I got my bachelor's degree was pretty much an expert in the Magna Carta. And I think one of them went for at auction for about 2.5 million pounds.
I went for auction?
Yeah, through, that's right, because he wrote the, not catalogue, but, the guff that goes with it sort of thing. Nicholas Vincent, his name is.
Right.
I feel so privileged to have studied, listened to him lecture about the Magna Carta. I've been extraordinarily lucky, especially to someone with my interests. But anyway, what was I saying? Oh, yes. So, around this time, everybody's just really, really unhappy with the king. But unfortunately for them, the Pope pretty much said, you can't make demands on a king. King is answerable only to God, even though John was fighting with the Pope at the time and was I can't go into all the history because it would take hours. But
yeah.
Oh, that's right. He fought with the Pope about electing the Archbishop of Canterbury. So, let me think. I have to keep it straight in my own head. Sorry if I'm going off on bits and tangents, but
that's cool.
Yeah. So yeah, John pretty much ignored it. He didn't really pay much attention to it. People tend to think of this document as, you know, this great, you know, they hold it up and everybody goes, oh, and everything's sorted. It's, that was absolutely complete garbage. That's right. And the man that I did my dissertation on in for my degree was a man by the name of William Marshall, who served about four kings during that era.
Okay.
And he's one of my, well, if not my historical hero. Jim will tell you. I think he's amazing. He became regent for John's son, whose name has just gone straight out of my head, Henry III. He became Henry III. When he was 9 years old. So William Marshall became regent of England for him.
Regent because he was too young.
He was too young, yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
Gotcha.
So the thing with the Magna Carta, there's different versions of it. They sort of repurposed it for their time. I think he resealed it. So they didn't sign documents, and that's a bugbear of any medieval historian. People didn't sign things. If you're a king, you attach your seal to it.
Yeah.
That's not like the animal. It's the not like, oh, or. No, that's pretty funny.
I shall attach this seal.
No, it's like a pretty much a wax document that you press onto.
Would someone club that one, please?
Come out and attach it. No, it's not cooperating. Yeah, you see these things where John's sitting down to sign it, and it's just like, you know, I just go off in a rage. It's like, they didn't sign things. Excuse me.
They would add seals in.
They'd add things.
That's the wax thing, isn't it?
Yeah. So, that it sort of went through different versions of it and that sort of thing. But it is, like I say, it probably was a point in time where people just saying, because there's always been a controversy about the power of kings, and it's like the church and state thing. The church pretty much wanted to be as powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another aspect of medieval history, because they had a lot of the land. Well, they held most of the land, let's say. And they had a lot of the wealth and the knowledge. They were the educated people. So, you know, they became a lot more powerful. And a lot of kings really butted heads with with the church. So,
well, everyone has their own little agenda as well, though, don't they?
Very much so, yeah, very much.
Because when the Romans kind of disbanded, fell, whatever you want, Christianity was kind of building up then, wasn't it? It's just been on a roll ever since.
Oh, yeah.
This William chap, then, what interests you about him? What spark grabbed your attention and you was like, oh, yeah, I must learn about this chap and hold him high aloft?
I think I have a great interest in people who survive against the odds. That's why I have a, apart from being a redhead, that's why I like Elizabeth I, because she became queen despite so many obstacles being put in her way, and she was actually in fear of her life a lot of the time.
Right.
And it's quite a similar thing. She had her chief minister, a guy by the name of William Cecil. No, sorry. Yeah, it was William Cecil, who was her strength and her big supporter. William Marshall was pretty much a younger son of I think they're from Wiltshire. And pretty much, what they call a knight errant was he was a knight that wasn't attached to any household. So, and he very much, he's been described as like the greatest knight. He, if you think of a knight in shining armor, it's probably this guy. You know, he was sort of big. A lot of the tournaments then were sort of, you know, you go out and fight one another, then you could hold people for ransom and people would actually have to pay you to release their relatives sort of thing, especially really? If you go and fight in foreign battles in foreign countries. A lot of the time you could actually get hold of the noble people and ransom them off. And that, that's how he built up and up. And that's how he came to the attention of, Eleanor of Aquitaine. I think he was guarding her, she was heading back to wherever she was, and there was a lot of unrest in the region. And he fought whoever was attacking them, and he was injured himself, but she managed to get away. And she basically went to this king, Henry II, and said, "You've got to get this guy on the payroll. He's amazing. You know, pay his ransom, get him into the household."
Brilliant.
So then he trained, like I said earlier, Henry the Young King in sort of like, you know, all the, they call it the chivalry and, you know, fighting and kingship and sort of educated him a lot. And I think what really I admire about him, like I say, he survived and he bent with the wind. He very much was his own man, but he sort of knew when to back down and keep his mouth shut, which, you know, sometimes he knew when to withdraw and basically, if the monarch was pissed at him, especially John. John was very capricious and could change from one day to the next.
Oh, that's exactly what you need, isn't it?
A monarch
that could just flip on a dime.
And that was the problem. Henry II was, you know, he was quite a. It was a good king. He introduced a lot of laws that we pretty much have come down to us. A lot of the not actual laws, but the you know the way that law is run now. He introduced a lot of reforms in that respect. That's why we don't have sort of kings that make the decisions now, because you get a good one. And then you get a really bad one. That's what it seems to go. Henry V, who won the Battle of Agincourt, great leader, awesome, you know, strong king. And then he has a son, Henry VI, who pretty much he just didn't want to be king. He just wanted to go to church and that was pretty much what it was like, you know.
And sit on his throne and that be it, really.
Perfectly nice man, but just didn't really have an opinion of his own. So that's, again, Wars of the Roses, that's where all that kicked off. So that's why we don't have but getting back to William, and the heiresses again, he married a woman by the name of Isabel de Clare, who again, women didn't really have a say in like who they married, but he was sort of given the right to marry her by, it was Henry II, but then Richard sort of said, right, yeah, okay, this is it. This is this heiress. You can marry her. And then he gets her land, in right of his wife. So, but, you know, they obviously got along fairly well because they had 10 children. She was 18, I think, when they married, and he was probably in his 40s. But she died not long after he did. So from reports, you can't read everything into history, but yeah, you know, they had a lot of kids.
Yeah, and you have to wonder how accurate it is as well. As you said earlier on, the history is written by the victors, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so this could be interpreted. If you have someone in favor of you writing your history for you, then they might pep it up a little bit, you know.
Well, you're exactly right. When we first started at university, they say to you, you've got to look at the sources, especially the primary sources. Like, when were they written? Why were they written? Who commissioned them? It's like the main thing that we've found about William Marshall was it's this massive, it's pretty much written as a poem. It's like his history, but it was commissioned by his son. So, you know, the guy who's writing it's not exactly going to say he's a bad guy, is he?
Of course not. No, he's got a legacy there to uphold, isn't he?
But I think that was where I was going with the Magna Carta thing, because the nobility despised John so much they actually invited the son of the King of France to come and take over, which it was unheard of. Prince Louis. And that's the other thing that I admire about William Marshall was he remained loyal no matter what. Mm-hmm. You know, he when Henry II's sons rebelled against him, which they did on a very regular basis, even Richard, at the end of Henry's life, William remained loyal to the king, even though how bad John was. Even one of William's sons fought for the other side. William Marshall remained loyal. And he, by that time, he was about 70. And he pretty much led, I know I'm saying pretty much a lot, but that's part of history is like, we're getting it from the sources. But he led an army at 70 to take one of the castles, Lincoln Castle.
See, that's not bad. I don't think I'm going to be leading an army at 70.
No.
And then we're talking 600 years prior to this. And I'm guessing if you're very, very rich and very, very wealthy and very well-to-do, you're living longer, but 70 must be pushing the absolute...
Unusual, peak. Very unusual, yeah. Again, Eleanor of Aquitaine, she lived a good old, I think she lived, well, she died in 1204. I think she was nearing 80. So that, but she probably spent the last few years of her life in a nunnery, so.
Yeah.
Was quite well looked after. And I've been to one of the abbeys, Fontevraud Abbey, which a lot of this sort of took place around that sort of region, which is a place called Poitiers, which is sort of I can't really describe it. But this massive abbey, if you look it up, it's where Henry II and Eleanor and I think it's Richard I and a queen by the name of Isabella of Angoulême, who was John's wife. So they're buried there, and their effigies are on display. This sort of all happened around a lot of it around that region. Well, that was where they were from. It's hard to describe. They'd invited the Dauphin of France over to oust John as king. And William, the young Henry III, was very vulnerable because different factions held different parts of England, and he protected him. And you know, there's a lot of sort of mythology builds up. Allegedly, he came and sort of said that, you know, I'll protect you, and if we have to leave England, I'll carry you on my shoulders. And yeah, you know, there's all this sort of yeah. I know. I know. But it must have worked because that's what I forgot to say. You know, John had died by this time. He died in October 1216. Magna Carta is 1215. Probably the best thing he could have done, really. that turned the tide. Really much, because what William Marshall did, with the support, obviously, of the new king's mother, Isabella, crowned Henry as Henry III. So what you've effectively got then is you have a crowned king. You're not going to invite a prince to take over from this crowned king.
No,
that's just not going to. Even if he is nine, you know, he's got the backing of, like I say, William Marshall. There was a he was a very high based cleric. I don't know, his name is escaped me, but another very powerful man. And they negotiated with the rebels and said, look, John's dead. You know, it's a new beginning. Let's just kick Louis out and, you know, let's just revise Magna Carta and let's just, you know, keep things. You have a crowned king.
So with Louis, what happens to him? Is he, like, executed or is he just banished somewhere?
The Battle of Lincoln, like Lincoln Castle, there was another naval battle later on, which the French lost. And that, after that, they pretty much just went home.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, no.
This English place. We will leave this until later.
I don't like this weather.
sorry, Odile, if you're listening. And then, like I say, Henry the Third became king, and we pretty much just went on from there.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, there's just something I really found, you know, about this guy who wasn't born to be what he became. I know he had a lot of, especially when he was betrothed to this Isabel. He couldn't have done what he couldn't have achieved what he did if he hadn't married her.
Mm.
Because he wouldn't have had the land, the wealth, the property, that sort of thing. But
yeah. Everything kind of fell into place, didn't it?
It was meant to be. And he managed to, like I say, he managed to stay alive long enough and outlive, Henry II, Henry the Young King, who technically was a king, Richard and John. Yeah, so he's survived four Angevin kings, which was a very, very massive achievement because they were all at each other's throats for a very long time.
Well, that I would imagine in that if you have a person who is going to rise to the crown, and you have other people following in the footsteps and seeing this other person waiting in the wings, there would, in a film or in a TV show, have been a situation where they try to knock off this person just in case.
Yeah, probably a lot of that would have gone on, and not only just bumping them off, but sort of discrediting them, and a lot of power shifts. And like I say, there's a lot of very powerful families, And it's all very much, which I think there was a series, The White Queen, which is my former housemaid made me watch an episode because she couldn't tell who was who. She's like, everybody's named Henry or Edward or Margaret. So you are welcome to the Middle Ages, baby. So it's fucking appalling. It was awful. But I had to sort of explain to her who everybody was. Yeah. And that was, again, it's like the Earl of Warwick was initially one of the king's best friends, Edward IV, and who effectively helped him seize power from Henry VI, the king I told you about, who was the son of Henry V, who was a very, very weak king. And that's, again, the Wars of the Roses. The Earl of Warwick was incredibly powerful, but he changed sides. And when this Edward married, she wasn't really a commoner, but she was probably not, you know, the marriages were with other royal families to gain territory, to have alliances. Same with Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
But he secretly married this woman, Elizabeth Woodville. And the Earl of Warwick was really, really not happy because he'd already set up this other marriage. I think it was a French princess. So, yeah, this was going on. It was probably, the Princes in the Tower?
Yes.
Yeah.
I've heard of it. I don't know much about it, but I've heard of it.
They were Edward IV died very suddenly in 1483. And his, again, there's like a saying, something about, you know, dangerous times when the king is a child. And Edward, what were you going to say?
I'm reading here. It was, he either died or was assassinated.
Edward
IV. Or was
that
someone else?
Anything's possible in those days. Like he did die very suddenly, but apparently I've heard that he was ill. He liked a party, shall we say? And he loved the girls? Jeez, he was
You would, wouldn't you? You would. Well, if you could party like that, I would be full of disease immediately. I would be riddled.
You'd be at it like a bloody rabbit, would you? Would. So he liked the old drink and liked the food, and he's unusual for the times. He was very tall, he was about 6'4". He's the grandfather of Henry VIII.
Okay.
And Henry himself was very tall. He was about 6'2". And that was unusual for those days. Apparently very, very charming, very personable, knew everybody's name. And he dies very suddenly in 1483. Edward he was never crowned, but he was technically Edward V and his younger brother Richard. Edward was 12, Richard was 9.
These are so young ages.
Yeah, children, yeah. Of course, everybody knows Richard III, who was Edward's brother. Cut a long story short. Takes him to the Tower of London. You know, the Tower at the time was a fortress for the royal family. If they were in danger, they would withdraw there. He took them there, and after a while, no one saw them again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the great mysteries of what happened to them.
Whether they fled or whether they were killed.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, open up a whole can of worms. in historical societies and everything. I think Richard probably, you know, he seized power. He basically said that Edward had a pre-contract of marriage with another woman.
Mm-hmm.
So technically his children were illegitimate, so they couldn't be king. So he said, I'm king now, and I'll put these boys in the tower, and for their protection, of course. And then,
oh yeah,
yeah. No one. After a while, no one saw them, and even at the time, there was a lot of controversy saying, you know, what the hell's happened to these boys? So yeah, never seen again. And that, but that then, Henry Tudor defeated Richard at the Battle of Bosworth. Now, okay. Henry Tudor was, he married Edward the Fourth's daughter, Elizabeth of York, who was the mother of Henry the Eighth. I know, okay. I've got it all in my head, but I know it's very confusing.
So no, then, it's just that our history, where it's just all Henrys and all Richards and and such. And just like a tangent off of this as well, kings and queens, they get to choose their name, don't they? They get to choose whether they're going to be called Richard or Henry. Am I right in thinking that?
No, not really.
I thought okay, I've got that completely wrong then. So let's say Charles, when he steps up to the throne, I don't know what number he would be.
He would be Charles the Third. Yeah, Charles that's III. Probably quite – actually, what you're probably thinking of is quite a modern thing, because I know the Queen's father can't remember his original name, but he took a different name.
Ah, okay.
And I can't remember. Was it Edward? Not Edward. No, probably people screaming at it, but I'm not a very good George. I think it was George. George the Sixth, I think. I don't know.
Right. Like, and so that's more of a modern thing where they get to choose
a name. I think it is, yeah. 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 I don't, not that I'm aware of anyway, that, you know, they sort of changed. A lot of, especially the nobles, would just name their children after the king or queen.
Yep.
Yeah, so a lot of that. Yeah, it does. Usually, I did do a module on Charlemagne and his, well, sort of his father and then him and then his children and grandsons. Another great leader, sort of around the 800s. But yeah, that's all Charles, Louis. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Charles, Louis, 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 Charles. Oh, God. Yeah. And like I say, a lot of the Anglo-Saxon names, though, you know, thank God, I always say thank God for the Normans, because of them that have Ethelfref and Freffelfref, and then. Then you get William and Thomas and Elizabeth.
Good, strong names.
I know, you bloody foreigners. but no, Edward is the only sort of Anglo-Saxon name. Everybody often thinks that's a Norman name, and that pretty much comes from the Anglo-Saxons.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
God, I feel so stupid not knowing any of this. I would love to know this. It's such a wide period of time, though, isn't it?
And you think, you know, I've been sort of reading and studying this for years. You know, I've always said to a lot of the younger people when I was in uni, I said, oh, I'm twice your age, so I've had, you know, double the reading time.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's just always been a massive passion for me. Some things I forget, but and I like to. A lot of people think that history and studying history is just remembering dates, but to me, it's trying to get to know who these people were, and not only the nobility, but the, you know, the ordinary people. You have to have a sense of how many people have gone before you, and it's difficult to describe. It's not just an interest; it's something I've always loved.
Yeah, it's something I feel I should have paid more attention to. Like when I was joined by Laura to talk about the wives of Henry VIII.
Oh yeah, I was going to say I really enjoyed that. Yeah, she was really good.
It's like an amazing journey.
It is, and like I said to you before, it's not just dates and battles. It is a story. It's a great story. You couldn't make this stuff up, especially the Angevins. They were, like I said, the devil's brood. They were at each other's throats, and intrigue and rebellion. It is just fascinating. But people forget that these are real people.
Yeah, and sometimes history is far more enjoyable and interesting than the latest HBO series. Really, I should be. That's why I spend a lot of time on Discovery and watching that sort of thing,
because
learning about stuff like that, and like the Smithsonian Channel, just learning about little things. But the problem I have is it just pops straight out, and I'm like, oh, I learned about that, and now it's gone again.
Yeah, you'd be surprised though. Sometimes when you try to think about something. Yeah, it's probably all in there, but like I said, a lot of the time it's just modern life. And you've got so much in your head.
Yeah.
That, I often think it's like, I don't really know much, but yeah, it is an amazing story. That's why I'm here, pretty much. That's why I'm over here.
Yeah. So, okay, with you coming over, when did you come over to this country?
I was originally born here. I was born in Swindon, but my family left when I was about a year old and went to Australia. I did sort of come back in the 90s for a couple of years, but then went back to Australia. But this time I came over in 2010, and it was to finish a Bachelor of Arts, it's called, history degree.
Right.
I'd done a year in Australia, part-time pretty much, for sort of virtually. But I'd always thought about studying in England, and I'd pretty much run out of modules that I could do over there. I could still probably get the history degree, but it would be in things that I wasn't really interested in. So came over and did finished my history degree. And then I met Jim and sort of did my master's degree in medieval history in York. So, Master of Arts it is. It makes you sound like a magician. I love it. Master of Arts in Medieval History.
So, coming back over here then, were you cracking your knuckles because it's, I get to go to England. I can visit these places as well.
It was. It really was. And like I said, I came over in 95 and landed in London, and I think one of the first places was the British Museum. Which is just, I've been there so many times, and the Tower of London and all that sort of thing. To me, that's just, it's just heaven. And luckily enough, I went to Norwich, and they have a very, very beautiful Norman cathedral, which was built by one of William the Conqueror's sort of, I don't know what he would be, bishops, I guess. And that's absolutely amazing. every time I'd went there so many times, and every time I'd notice something different. But you know, that was probably built around the 1090s. Obviously, it's it used to have a wooden roof, but after it'd been struck by lightning about three times, they thought, you know, I think we might make this out of stone.
Keeps breaking down, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's right. It is just an amazing place that's had so many people go, you know, hundreds of years of history. And that to me is just like I just go in and just breathe it in. It's just heaven. And I look at the steps, and they are worn. You know, the stone steps. How many?
Yeah.
Hundreds of thousands of people have walked up and down them. What were their lives like?
Well, you know? Yeah, that was one thing I was going to ask you about going like to the Tower of London, because it's always been there for us, isn't it?
And
it would continue. It will be there long after I'm dead.
Yeah. Oh, long after we're gone. Yeah.
Yeah. And people will still walk up them steps, but then there's something about going to a place. And it sounds weird, but walking through the same archways, through the same air as the other people have walked through, sitting in the same places, looking, actually seeing the steps as you walk up and thinking, this person has seen these steps.
Yeah.
That's the history that really gets me.
It's mind-blowing, really. Yeah. It is. That's really sort of how I see it and how I look at things like that. You know, you're going around and this place has seen hundreds of years of, and it's still there, and it's still sort of like it just watches everything go by. And unfortunately, we don't have that many that can go back that far.
No.
So, and that's what makes these things so precious.
Oh, well, I have a castle just up the road from me.
Oh, have you?
I've Heddenham Castle, and that was built around 1100.
Ooh.
So that's a Norman keep.
Yes, yeah.
And just to think of when they were building that, did they really know that they were going to have car shows in the grounds at the time?
Really?
and lots of people turning up on their steel horses, in other words, their motorbikes.
Oh, God. Well, that was the thing, another thing with the Norman castles, and how they pretty much subjugated the people. Was they built stone castles, whereas before a lot of were pretty much timber. Well, timber, wood, whatever you want to call it. But, which pretty much said to the people, like, we're here and we're staying. We're not going anywhere.
Try and burn it down.
Try and knock this down. Yeah, good luck to you. Yeah.
You ain't ramming this one down.
Nope.
It is like a letter of intent, isn't it? It's, this is staying here and this will be here for hundreds of years.
Yeah, exactly. That was exactly the point. Same with the cathedrals. You know, look how rich and powerful we are.
Yeah. Try and remove us from your lives. Yeah,
exactly.
I dare you.
Nope, not going to happen.
So are there places that you want to visit or have visited or like to visit again?
So many. I can't even list them all.
You've been to Hastings, though, haven't you?
Yeah, a long time ago. Yeah, that was probably about 95, 96.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to go there again.
You were over here during the indie days.
The what? Which one?
The music scene.
Oh.
Cool Britannia, all that malarkey.
Oh, right. Yeah, all that. Blur and all that.
Yeah, basically human peak of existence.
Right.
It's all downhill from the 90s, and that's it.
Yeah, probably right there. I'd love to go to Dover Castle because apparently it is absolutely magnificent. I'd like to see a lot of beautiful castles in Wales. Oh, yep. I love Scotland too. I'd love to go back to Scotland.
I'd love to go to Scotland.
Oh, it's amazing.
I'd love to go to Scotland before they actually leave the United Kingdom as well.
Yeah. Edinburgh Castle. If you ever get a chance, go there. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. So, yeah, there's probably loads of places. A lot of places in France I'd still like to go to.
Mm. Yeah, I've been to Notre Dame. Because you have to, don't you?
Oh, of course, yeah. I was gorgeous. I was just devastated when that caught fire.
That is such a... I think when we went there, when would it have been? It would have been before we had Jacob. So
wow.
I reckon about 2002 I ended up there.
Yeah.
And
amazing.
It had scaffolding up the left-hand side, but it was still stunning to walk around and see the great bells. Yeah, the big windows and...
Mm.
See, I love these old buildings like this. Even when I'm at work and I end up in a church, working in a church, and you're like, how much history is in this?
Yeah, yeah.
It's a real bonkers to think about.
It is a real buzz when you really get in tune and you think about it. It's amazing.
But then living. Do you have any concept of how they lived like day to day? Like how would that be? How would someone earn money? Would I now in my, I'm working class, aren't I? So
yeah,
I suppose I would work in the fields or work in one of the big houses and
something like that. Or you'd be a craftsman, what do you call it?
I'll be a blacksmith. There we go.
Blacksmith or a carpenter or, That's what we said when I went on a trip with my group from university to Poitiers. Like we say, you wouldn't, you'd be a craftsman somewhere, but you'd be working on this building for years and years and years. So you wouldn't have to, just go and, whack a few boards up and be done in a week. You'd be working somewhere for about 30 years or something like that. If you were lucky,
it'd be a lifetime's work.
Yeah, it was. And a lot of, the stonemasons, they were real actual craftsmen and extremely clever. Their ingenuity is, for one of my, trips with the University of York. Well, after I graduated, actually, we went up into one of the towers in York Minster and saw a lot of the sort of the stonemason, a lot of their templates and things like that. It was just fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Just their ingenuity and their skill was extraordinary. So you had a lot of people like that. Obviously, you had your yeoman farmers and I don't really like to say the peasant class, but they pretty much kept things ticking along on the farms. Yeah. Mm. So it was only really in the moving toward the Tudor period you get probably more of what you would call not so much a middle class, but someone who wasn't a peasant and wasn't a lord. They were sort of like would guess middle class. They had a bit of a disposable income.
Yeah,
They were like the traders, like the wool merchants, and because a lot of that trade was building up sort of around that time. So they
would have the businesses of the trade, wouldn't they?
Very much so, and that was absolutely huge during that time. They'd be trading with the sort of what they call the Low Countries, like the Belgium and Holland, and so a lot of the cloth trade was massive in that time.
Really?
Mm, yeah, a lot of people made their fortunes. Yeah, so. isn't
so would that be importing it from Belgium and Holland and over to this country, or vice versa?
Yeah, both, I would say. Yeah, a lot of trade between the two. Yeah.
I don't know if I'd last 2 minutes though. I probably would. I think
you wouldn't know any different.
Well, yeah. If you grow up in that thing, it's like nowadays, you know, I live in my own little house, and in 100, 200 years' time, people look back on us and go, oh, my God, I wouldn't survive 10 minutes. Working from, like, 16 until you're 70? No, that would never do.
I know. Yeah, well, hopefully we're going back towards, you know, like I said before, people were very much worked with the seasons and don't have to be, you know, 8 till 4 or whatever and then have a couple of days off at Christmas time and then go straight back to work. You know, they really sort of moved more with the seasons and the days, you know, daylight, and they didn't make an artificial world for themselves by having false light and, you know, do you know what I mean? Back in those times, it was dark.
Yeah.
You don't realise how much, until you actually go out into the countryside, how much light we get used to and how much sound.
Yep.
How noisy things are. And
I think I've said this in a previous episode, but where I'm living at the moment, the castle Heddenham and like the village parish council,
okay,
they insist on no street lamps in our village.
Oh.
They insist on it because they don't want that ruining anything around us. And so we don't have, it's dark. Trust me, it gets really dark. You go out and it's black.
Yeah. I can sort of see where they're coming from, but I don't know if I feel safe going walking around at night time.
Well, it's a nice little village, and so
it's quite a small village, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah, so everyone walks to the pub and then everyone walks home and that's it.
Yeah, that sounds nice. But I can see what they're thinking, yeah.
Nowadays, if you had like a whole city just go dark just to save power, then nobody would go out.
No.
It would just be like the purge all over again.
Yeah, it wouldn't. No rules. Everybody just go and do whatever they want.
Yeah, stay indoors, otherwise you die.
You That's die, the way yeah. It is. Yeah, barricade yourself in. Oh, dear.
Cool. Well,
probably listen to me prattle on for long enough, I guess.
No.
Gone really quickly, actually.
Well, should we draw it to a close there then?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Otherwise, go on for hours and hours and my throat's getting a bit sore.
No, that's fine. Is there anything that that we've missed that you desperately want to mention, or have we covered all the bases that you wanted to touch on?
I think we've pretty much covered a lot of my sort of area of interest.
Yeah.
Sort of different areas of interest. And no, I pretty much, I think I've said what I was thinking about saying, but I was really nervous about sort of, oh God, I'm going to sound like I'm not know anything. You know, you get that sort of panic. It's, oh my God.
Oh, okay, no, I've been panic really pleased. I get the panic at every single episode of this. I do.
Yeah.
Don't worry.
No, you always do a great job because you're actually willing to learn and are interested, which is, you know, is fantastic, especially for someone who's like, you know, I don't want to sound patronizing to people because, oh, yeah, this isn't this. And it's like, yeah, all right, whatever.
The thing I find about this show is I think, okay, I'm going to go into it. I'll might do a bit of research, might not do a bit of research. It really just depends on how I feel.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can work for you and can work against you. So
very much so.
There's an idea of going into you could do like an interview with someone and read their book and then go, oh, well, tell me about this and tell me about this. Or you could go into the interview and not read the book and say, tell me about your book.
What's it all about? Yeah, that's a good way to approach it. And like I said before, it's such a wide subject. Where do you start?
Yeah. And what I've found when I've done these types of episodes, I've done a lot more research after the episode.
Yeah, well, it just opens really up your, I've probably mentioned a few things that you didn't really know about. So, yeah, absolutely. It opens up so many different aspects of the topic.
Yeah, well, I think I'm going to plow my nose into War of the Roses.
Oh, yeah, it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating.
I'm going to dive into that, I think. I'm going to find something about it and just attach myself to it.
Yeah, that's a good idea. I'll definitely endorse that.
Good. Yeah. Okay, well, with that being said, do you have any other shows that you partake in or on the internet anywhere? Do you know where these are held and kept?
I knew you were going to ask me that. And like, Jim is the one who is the caretaker of all these things. I would just refer you to Hypnagoria. What was the last one? We just did Santa Sleigh, which is Commentary Club, which I do. That's on Hypnagoria. He's in full flow with his Christmas podcasts. Like I say, he's doing a lot of the mythology, like the Tom D's and a lot of other stuff that I can't. It's terrible off the top of my head. Like, he's like an encyclopedia about these things. Like, I've got this going out this week and that week. It's like, whatever.
He puts everyone to shame.
He does. We do, like I say, the Commentary Club, and he's got to space these things out in different weeks. Like, which one's that one, when, what, how? But, yeah, I just refer you everything to him.
Cool. So, yeah, everyone go over to hypnagoria.com and download everything. Five-star reviews on everything as well, please.
Oh, yeah. And he does. He puts in so much work and so much research and yeah, it's he's pretty amazing. Yeah, it's probably,
He is, isn't he?
Yeah, I know. That's why I married him. One day I might pull my finger out and do a podcast on my passion, but find the time.
That's the hardest thing with it.
And getting consistency, which is what a lot of podcasts, they come out every so often. And yeah, you got to keep this, and it is. It's keeping the enthusiasm and the drive to just to keep doing it.
Yeah, it is. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to keep the consistency. I know the last couple of months I've been off the ball a little bit, but
very trying.
I've tried my best.
Oh no, I think you've done fantastically well. When you said you were bringing the Shonky Lab back, I was over the moon, because I've listened to it for, it's one of the first ones I listened to.
With
the Black Dog.
Yeah, it's 10 years old in January next year.
Yeah, yeah.
10 years old. That's bonkers.
Yeah, it's crazy. You're one of the pioneers. You are.
I thought I came to it late. Because I started in 2008. Oh, God, I rhymed it again. Jeez.
It's funny how often that happens.
Yeah, I'm a poet and didn't realise. No, damn, I didn't do it right.
Oh, I did it right.
Yeah. 2008, and I thought I was behind the times. Mm. But looking back on it, I was kind of first floor, maybe second floor. in the grand scheme of things. So 2004, 2005, that's when it really started officially. But
yeah,
I could say I was at not ground zero, but maybe the first floor.
Yeah, no, I do remember, back in the old days.
Yeah, the good old days before all the crap that happened in 2016 onwards, really.
Pretty much. It's terrible, isn't it? Oh, we'll muddle through somehow.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I will bring it to a close. Thank you very much, Teresa. That's been a pleasure.
Right. No, same. And, I don't always get to talk about my passion a lot, even though, we do it at home. A lot of other people just get that glazed over look when they start talking about history, which is fine. I probably do when you start talking about a lot of other stuff, so that's fine. But no, it's been great, and hopefully I haven't, ratted on too much.
No, you're fine. It's been excellent.
Yeah.
And it just leaves me to say, please leave quietly. This is a residential area.